Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Ethnic Mexicans and Mexican Americans have a long, complicated history in their search for belonging in the United States. The 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo ended a war between the U.S. and Mexico and ceded hundreds of thousands of square miles of Mexico to the U.S. It established the Rio Grande as the U.S.-Mexico border and created the first Mexican Americans. Mexican Americans never felt like true U.S. citizens, despite being promised all the rights of citizenship. The sense of belonging has been unstable in the decades that followed. Writer and historian Dr. Aaron E. Sanchez writes about this struggle in his book Homeland, Ethnic Mexican Belonging Since 1900. The book weaves history with poetry and writings of the time to explore the ways ethnic Mexicans viewed, rejected, or embraced citizenship over time. The book does not start at that critical point in history in 1848 with the signing of a document that asked Mexicans to choose between the country they've always known or the new country in which they found themselves. Sanchez explains why he chose to start the book in the years prior to the Mexican Revolution, an event that changed the face of the U.S. Southwest when hundreds of thousands of Mexican nationals fled north to escape the violence.
I don't begin in the 1848, which is a very pivotal turning point in Chicana and Chicano and Chicanx history. The Mexican Revolution, because it causes so many folks to migrate. Conservatively, we're looking at maybe 1 to 1.5 million folks by different measurements. And so in the census, like the 1930 census, we get a number that's around a million or so. And that's probably a significant undercount. And so before, of course, there are these communities of both folks, people of Mexican descent born in the United States, and then folks who are from Mexico. So there's quite a few communities of ethnic Mexicans that existed. And at that time, the interactions are fairly friendly, and there's what some historians had called a strong Mexicanist tradition. They saw themselves as Mexicano. It didn't really matter what side they came from. But it's when so many folks move into these neighborhoods, like the west side of San Antonio, start moving into the Segundo of El Paso, start moving into other areas across the Southwest, where those differences start to become much more exaggerated and start to become much more noticed. And that's when they start to say, no, we're not all Mexicanos here. There's a group of folks who really are Mexican, and then there's a group of folks who are something different. And so in those years during and after the Mexican Revolution, we see that that very concept of Mexicanness is challenged and revised, and you know, these competing ideas of Mexicanness emerge.
And I know we see this sort of amongst ourselves as Mexican Americans in our communities, that sometimes we may not look upon our fellow ethnic Mexicans, Latinos, in a particular way. You know, there is almost a sense of discrimination amongst ourselves. And you point that out in this particular time period where you have these people who came in from Mexico, fleeing the violence, coming to the United States, wanting to go back to Mexico and looking down upon these pochos, these Americanized Mexicans who are becoming less and less Mexican in their viewpoint.
Yes. I mean, the idea that there are these pochos and pochas everywhere was really interesting. There's so much ink spilled on this concept of the pocho and the pocha. And that was initially what drew me in as a shorter research paper into this topic, because the question is, why? And so those folks who move in, they create what's often called a Mexico. They use the phrase themselves, as well as historians have used it, a Mexico de afuera. A crude translation is a Mexico outside of Mexico, but it meant so much more than that. And in a lot of ways, they're folks who are of different political stripes. So there are some conservative folks who were supportive of, say, the prior president of Mexico, Porfirio Diaz. Later on, there's some of these reforming type liberals who had initially supported someone like the president who was then later deposed, Francisco Madero. So there's all these different political stripes. But when they get to the United States, they agree that they're living a bit in exile, and it's their responsibility to go back and remake the country right. So there's an article written in a newspaper there called Emigrated Mexico and Enslaved Mexico. And it says that, like, emigrated Mexico will go back and save enslaved Mexico. It was their responsibility, these folks living in exile, to maintain a pristine Mexicanness, right? Like, they represented the very essence of the nation. And then they needed to keep that pristine essence and then return and reestablish it and then create the nation anew. And if they didn't, then the nation will go away. It will disappear. It will be their fault that Mexico as an idea and a nation go away. And so when they start looking around at some folks, especially folks born in the United States, well, they're starting to mix English and Spanish. They're starting to smoke American cigarettes instead of corn husk cigarettes. So some might even, you know, do horrible things like cut their hair in a bob instead of maintain trenzas or something like that. And so they were already seeing the kinds of things that could happen. And they started calling these folks pochos and pochas. And they're saying, this is dangerous because these adaptations could mean an end to what we need. And so these folks in Mexico de Afuera kind of kick U.S.-born Mexicans or these increasingly bicultural ethnic Mexicans out of Mexico de Afuera intentionally. And that's going to have all kinds of political ramifications. It's going to have a lot of ramifications in terms of ideas and identities as well.
Well, that identity is something that these, I guess, maybe former pochos and pochas eventually came to embrace. They realized, you're right, in Homeland that in order to become a part of the U.S. and sort of separate themselves from the Mexicans in exile, they wanted to be seen as a part of the United States. And that was another sort of evolution of belonging with establishment of civil rights organizations like LULAC, which required citizenship for membership. And they wanted to sort of elevate the status of Mexican Americans from the pocho and pochas to more of a middle class type of status.
Yeah, there was lots going on at the beginning of the 20th century. And so it is the rise at the same time of the nation state, the importance of the nation state. We're starting to see borders start to matter. We're starting to see citizenship change and start to matter, that citizenship had existed in the United States before, but the nation state maintained to extract some things from its citizens. It's starting at the beginning of the 20th century where it's going to both have privileges and benefits, but it's also going to come with requirements. And so Mexican Americans are understanding of that. There's also getting kicked out of Mexico de Afuera that's impacting them. And so Mexican Americans are starting to say, okay, we've got to do something about this. We don't live in Mexico anymore. And the fact that they get kicked out of Mexico de Afuera really does sting for some of these folks, but they're also recognizing that there's some legitimate economic, political, material benefits to being an American citizen, right? That they need to be recognized as such to deal with some of the discrimination and exclusions that they're facing. And so they want to recognize their citizenship. They want to highlight it. And they also want the U.S. government, the U.S. state, to see them as American citizens as well. In the book, I look quite a bit at San Antonio because it's such an important city in Mexican-American history. We start to see that these groups used to have things like mutualistas or mutual aid societies that included both Mexican nationals and U.S.-born Mexicans in them. We start to see for the first time these organizations that say, no, 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 this is just for U.S. citizens. And that's a big change, again, making these distinctions now between Mexican nationals and the term they start using, Mexican Americans. And so in those organizations, you see that they're responding to discrimination by saying, well, you can't discriminate against citizens in this way, right? They want to be recognized, but they're almost playing down that they're not these deformed, sad pochas and pochos, that they're full 100% loyal American citizens in a way. In these groups, they're doing all of that work, they're having all of those conversations at once. They're really complex, important, and interesting groups to look at in the 1920s and 1930s.
The chapters sort of break it down by decades, which are really fascinating. And you trace sort of how these organizations are being challenged by what eventually becomes the Chicano movement and sort of this hard shift to the left, liberalism, and sort of not necessarily wanting to be a U.S. citizen, but sort of aligning more as global citizens.
So the forces of nationalism, as we've seen in the past and in the present, can be good and they can be bad, right? The forces of nationalism can certainly grow our circle of compassion, but it can also encircle it. It can limit it, right? So it can expand it in lots of positive ways, but it can also say, we don't care about these folks anymore. And so, in a way, Mexican Americans, through claiming citizenship, was trying to get them included in that circle of people Americans care about, but it also then would encircle or encompass or limit Mexican American compassion as well. And so there were folks even pushing against the confines or that limited scope of caring embedded in citizenship. And so you did have an ethnic Mexican left in the 1930s who were critical of the efforts of Mexican Americans at the time, too. They said, no, we should care about all exploited workers and that kind of leftist internationalism that we're all workers of the world and we all need to unite. But they said the basis for why we care about each other isn't just citizenship, it's that we're human beings and that we're workers. That gets tamped down, it gets limited in the kind of Cold War period. The World War II comes, it's a period of patriotism. We're going to see some Red Scare, a bit of political repression. And so that ethnic Mexican left doesn't go away completely, but it's going to have to go underground, right? And so, and again, another one amazing place like San Antonio, you have Emma Tenayuca, who leads this strike, who's a card-carrying communist through the 1930s. She just doesn't disappear. She's around, but she's going to be blacklisted. She'll have limited options. And so Mexican Americanism, especially in the 40s and 50s, becomes the most prominent idea and political practice that Mexican Americans have for those middle decades, but it's not the only one. Chicana and Chicanos, this generation that comes out that isn't just about like, we're 10 years older, 15 years older, they really start to evaluate some of the claims that the political practices of Mexican Americans were supposed to bring, right? And so they focused on becoming a bit more middle class, accommodationist folks who participate in electoral politics, and the change will come slowly and eventually. And so we have a generation in the 60s and 70s who are looking around and said, now we've been doing this for two decades or so, and we don't see enough change. The living conditions in a place like the west side of San Antonio would be remarkably similar. There'd be kind of a persistence of high levels of disease. Folks would still be using pit latrines in those areas into the 1960s. And so they say something needs to change, right? Our politics, our ideas should change. Maybe even the terms that we're using should change. And we should see ourselves as not just a smaller, limited kind of ethnic community in the United States, but a larger collection of folks dedicated to making the world a more just and dignified place. That our issues that are impacting us, yes, they're local in some aspects, yes, they're national, but they're also global. They globally interconnect us. And so, because of that, we should be concerned about making the world a fairer, better place.
Aaron Sanchez is an assistant professor of history at Texas Tech University. He's the author of Homeland, Ethnic Mexican Belonging Since 1900. When we come back, the ideas of belonging circulated among ethnic Mexicans and Mexican Americans primarily through arts and culture.
But the reality is, most of us don't get our ideas from going home and reading the New England Journal of Medicine, right? For better or worse, most of us get our ideas from popular culture, for better or worse.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Aaron Sanchez is an intellectual and cultural historian of the U.S. Southwest. He explores how ethnic Mexicans have struggled with and adapted their perceptions of citizenship in the U.S. in the book Homeland, Ethnic Mexican Belonging Since 1900. It's not necessarily an academic perspective of over a century of immigration, adaptation, and resistance. It's an intellectual history that includes ideologies, thoughts, and beliefs from the people who experienced those times. Art, literature, and poetry have framed how ethnic Mexicans defined belonging, whether it was early 20th century Mexican nationals writing romantic songs about their beloved homeland while they were biding time in the U.S. after the Revolution, or the Chicano activists in the 1960s who published poetry in Nahuatl to honor the mythical homeland of Aztlán. Words and images created a consciousness and a new way of looking at the world. Aaron Sanchez explains why those words and images were so important in crafting his book, Homeland.
The poetry and the literature as a cultural and intellectual historian is always what interests me. Not that there's not censuses and more traditional primary source materials, but those are the things that I found most compelling. And so there's a series of novels that I look at in the book, once called El Sol de Texas, or translated Under the Texas Sun. There's one called Los Pochos that's written around the same time by these exiled Mexican journalists. The other is Las Aventuras de Don Chipote, or Cuando los Pericos Mamen. And so these novels look at the experience of either sometimes Mexican individuals or especially Mexican families. Los Pochos and El Sol de Texas looks at these families who come to the United States, and they're generally like allegories. So Sol de Texas follows the Garcias and the Quijanos, and one family comes and they stay responsibly and respectfully Mexican, and they're the good guys in the story. And then there's another family that comes to the United States and they do it all wrong. And so at the end of the novel, the one family who had stayed responsible and respectful gets to return to Mexico. And the father of the Pocho family sees them at the train station, and he kind of tells them like they wouldn't be able to return because they're too embarrassed to. Right? Like there's no way they could go back to their communities in Mexico and ever show their face because their son's kind of this lazy alcoholic. Their daughter ran off with an American, with a white American boy, and now she's pregnant and they're not married, right? Such a scandal, I know. But they could never go back. And the book is more or less saying that those are the people who have stayed, right? Like Mexican Americans are all this family who have either become a bunch of flappers and drunks, and the respectful, responsible Mexicans return. Those ideas were everywhere. They were just being told in this really interesting and compelling narrative in the book. So the Mexican anthropologist Manuel Gamios also conducting interviews at the same time between 1926 and 1928. And he's finding those same ideas when he's interviewing folks. Those interviews are also included in the book. But Conrado Espinosa, the author of Sol de Texas, this journalist, is writing in such a compelling and intriguing way that you had to use that book. Well, you didn't have to use that book, but it was a much more interesting way to tell this history of ideas, that you see it in highbrow, middlebrow, and lowbrow forms of popular culture. It was ubiquitous in these communities, in the stories that they're telling about themselves in this time period. And so literature really seemed important. And popular culture in the history of ideas has had this interesting place. Often the history of ideas focused on very highbrow academic or technical fields of expertise. So you'd look at medical journals, academic journals. But the reality is most of us don't get our ideas from going home and reading the New England Journal of Medicine, right? For better or worse, most of us get our ideas from popular culture, for better or worse. And so I thought going to these sources, these popular culture sources, got us to a much more, not real, but I think a more telling history of ideas of where many folks would be getting those ideas.
And what I think is interesting is, you know, you're referencing the family of the good Mexicans and the bad Mexicans. It's funny how referencing the old saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Referencing another pop culture film, Selena, where Selena's father, Abraham, says to her, we're not Mexican enough and we're not American enough. And that seems to have been an idea that has been in place relatively unchanged since maybe the start of the timeline of your book, since the Mexican Revolution.
Yeah, it is. We often hear folks say that history repeats itself. But the reality is, right, like most historians we study, change over time or why things stay the same over time. So continuity or change. And so that continuity is an important feature of Mexican American history. And that has to do with these cycles of migration, these communities where you have recent arrivals and people who have lived in those places for generations upon generations, and the kind of interesting conflicts or accommodations that they make for each other. And so, like the famous Selena speech that we have to be more Mexican than the Mexicans and the more Americans than Americans, or that we're pochas and pochos. I mean, some of us have been called pocha and pocho, sometimes lovingly, other times not so much. And so this is a story that continues. This is a theme. This is an idea. This is a history that continues to impact us today.
Well, I mean, your book, again, continues to take us through pretty much the modern day. I'm wondering how you have thought about or have reflected on the current trend of Latinos veering to the right politically, and if there was maybe something that you've observed in what may have been maybe the pivotal point for that occurring.
Great question. My next long-term research project, my next academic history that I'll get out here and who knows how long, but hopefully a couple of years, is actually a study of Mexican-American conservatism. And so conservatism is a big complex body of thoughts with lots of strands. And I looked at one with a long history or tradition within the Mexican-American community, which I call civil rights social conservatism. So this is a particular type of conservatism that also promotes civil rights. And usually when I talk about that, folks are like, so does that explain Trump and the rightward shift? And I want to say, no, unfortunately, I wish then I could be tragically relevant. But in that case, this one is a little bit different. I think what we're seeing recently is we do want to think about some of these turns in political ideas, primarily as either Mexican or Latino or intra-community. And I think what we're seeing is can be rooted much more in U.S. politics and U.S. ideas. And so you see kind of right turns among men. You see right turns among men with lower levels of education or less levels of education. You're seeing a bit more liberalizing forces among women, and especially women with higher levels of education. And if you're looking at the Latino community, well, Latinas are graduating high school at higher rates. Latinas are graduating from college at much higher rates. I mean, Latinas are getting it done. And so then the kind of middle class blue collar jobs in the United States have been eroding since the 1970s. We're looking at a half century of deindustrialization. And so those folks who aren't keeping up in what was supposed to be the knowledge economy have been suffering for quite a long time. And Latinos aren't exempt from that. But they do turn to key industries. Some, if we're looking at a place like along the border and in the valley, the Border Patrol pays pretty well for a job in those areas, right? If you're living in El Paso, they pay pretty well in those areas. Joining the military it gives you a career path. Joining law enforcement gives you a career path. And those places generally come with a culture and a sense of self and ideas that tend to lean in a much more conservative way. And so I think some of those turns have more to do with not that Latinos are separate or apart. Some of those turns have more to do that they are becoming much more integrated or mainstream, right? Like that those prejudices aren't Latino prejudices, but more broadly American prejudices or American policies and ideas. I'll be finishing up the manuscript and hopefully getting it out pretty quickly, but I'm finishing up a collection of what I call historically informed creative nonfiction essays. And so these are essays, I mean, the essay format used to be one of the most important formats of kind of American public intellectual life. And our last significant essayist in, say, like the Latino community was probably someone like Richard Rodriguez in the early 90s. I wouldn't say this is Richard Rodriguez-esque, but it's in that essay format. But what I'm doing with this one is looking at, it's split into, the first half is historically informed creative nonfiction nature writing. We don't often have too many Latinos in nature writing, which I think is unfortunate. Many of those essays have to do with the fact that my family and I love to be outside and outdoors. And often when we're together and I'm traversing the Southwest and the Mountain West, the parts of this country that I love, that I feel most at home, that I feel like I belong most in, I can't but think about these places historically. And so my poor children, we might be walking and they have to hear me elaborate on this history. Well, now I've written some of these essays in where walking across these places, visiting these places, also touched back into the history. And I kind of go in and out of history and nature writing in those. The other set of essays are personal essays, which again, I'm a historian. And so I explain so much of the present through the past. And so I look at little episodes in my life, and then I explain those historically. And so I have an essay on there that is called Grammar Lessons from My Mexican Mother. And so growing up, my mother always changed the words to every song. And I never realized I learned it, quote unquote, wrong until I would go to school. So something like Mary Had a Little Lamb. Sometimes it was Elisa Had a Giraffe. And so that was just a regular occurrence for us. And I never thought anything about it until I went to school and realized, like, no, it can't be Elisa Had a Giraffe. It has to be Mary Had a Little Lamb. And so that essay, I actually go into the history of Mary. There was an actual Mary, and one day a lamb of Mary's followed her to school one day, like the song says. And then it was turned into a poem that later turned into a song that was then used in grammar schools to teach students about behavior and comportment and things like that. And so it's a history that looks at the actual history of the song and what grammar did. And really that there were these ideas that maybe the things we're supposed to learn are supposed to be rote. Right? Like that there's rules in this country that we have to learn verbatim and we have to follow them absolutely without changing. And what I realize is that there is that strong tradition, but there's also another tradition in the United States when it looked at grammar. It's about teaching people the structure and the rules to let them create something new and that's all their own, right? That knowledge can be about power and limiting what you can do, but it can also be this amazing tool that gives you the power to open up the world. And that my mother, when she was teaching me these songs incorrectly, was actually teaching me a kind of American grammar that has existed in our country that gives us the freedom to use language as we see fit, gives us the freedom to change things when we need to create altogether amazing and new things. And that too is American.
Dr. Aaron Sanchez is an intellectual and cultural historian and is an assistant professor of history at Texas Tech University. He is the author of Homeland, Ethnic Mexican Belonging Since 1900. His forthcoming collection of historically informed creative nonfiction essays is tentatively titled My Lifelong Question of Country, Essays on the Southwest. Thanks for joining us today for Fronteras. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marianne Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.